Good morning. It's time for the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Well, good morning. My name's Dave Kibikian.
And good morning. I'm Jay Marie Schaefer.
Hi, Jay Marie. Jay Marie and I are two of the principals at the Herzog Law Firm, and we are here every weekend talking to you about what we do for a living, right, Jay Marie? Estate planning, Medicaid planning, elder law. It happens to be an incredibly interesting area of law and unfortunately a part of life that you just can't seem to avoid. So planning around it becomes really, really important. We have offices in Albany, Clifton Park, and Saratoga Springs, as well as down in Kingston, and we pretty much serve all in New York, I think, Jay Marie. We'd love for you to be a caller today at 518-476-5900, or we're happy to do a free consult for you at one of our offices at 518-465-7581. What's up, Jay Marie? How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I was in our Kingston office yesterday afternoon. It's looking good. Pictures falling.
Ben, you know, I think you've heard this. I'm not sure if you know, but Jane Marie decorated Kingston. We talked about it a couple weeks ago. Wonderful job. But she hung things in ways that make me suspect that she's trying to take me out.
Why is that?
Well, I've had four pictures fall near and around me. One during a client meeting. It was a rather big frame. And you know, she used, like, scotch tape to hang things.
So. Oh, Jay Marie is one of those people. Okay.
Jay Marie had said, you know, she suggested that in our largest conference room in Albany, maybe we put a TV in there for training, and we could basically get a computer screen on there, and, you know, wonderful idea. And our only rule is that she is not allowed to hang it. Otherwise, we're good.
I love it.
Oh, come on. The double-sided tape, that works perfectly, right?
Yeah, for about three minutes.
In elementary school for popsicle sticks, yes, it works perfect.
I don't know how that picture fell down on you in the conference room. I think you must have.
I actually think it wasn't your fault. I think my chair might have touched it. So it was so delicate. It was better me than anyone else. Anyway, how are you doing? How's work? How's life? We never talk. We never see each other in the office.
I know we don't. We're one of the other offices, right? I'm doing well. I'm looking forward to the warmer weather. We're not quite there yet, but at least it's sunny out.
Well, on Friday, it's April 1st. It's coming Friday. So we're through, and already spring, right? We talked about that last week. And spring already. The weather will probably start to be springy in the next couple of weeks, and then Easter, and then game on. So your wish is going to happen. Hopefully it's a nice long, you know, an Indian summer and so on down the road. Jimmy, I had a client yesterday, an existing client, and I thought they were a wonderful example of the reason why your estate plan is maybe a little more complicated than people think. Not complicated in that, you know, it's hard to understand, just complicated in that there's a lot of moving pieces to the plan. Mm-hmm. And so let me lay this on you, and callers, feel free to jump in whenever you want. So existing couple, and I, they're not one of my clients, they're a client of Harry's, and I met with them yesterday. They had gotten a letter from us saying, we haven't seen you in about 5 years. You may want to poke your head in and say hello. So they decided to do that. And all along the way, which is pretty cool, the spouse, the wife, she had been watching webinars. So she kind of already knew me, even though I had never met her through the webinars, and she found them very informative, and that was very nice of her to say to me. So when I looked at their documents, Jamie, they had a revocable trust in place. Ah. That was their big document, revocable. And so everyone out there knows already revocable. That kind of trust is usually reserved for people who simply want to avoid probate, get money to the right people, you know, who gets what. And it's not about long-term care planning, because revocable trusts don't protect assets in case you need to qualify for Medicaid down the road, because you have such easy access to those assets as the creator of this thing that you by yourself can undo. It doesn't work. So, it basically was for one of two reasons. Either they had really good long-term care insurance they were never going to give up, or they were doing pretty well investment-wise, and they have, enough money where the Medicaid rules aren't really going to help them all that much if they did a trust. So it ended up being the latter, where they're doing all right, and long-term care is just not a consideration. So we went through all these beats with them and made sure that that's exactly what they were thinking, and there's no need to amend their trust to become a different kind of trust, which you do all the time. Mm-hmm. So we just started talking about like that old-fashioned who gets what estate planning, which is, does mm-hmm. this plan reflect your wishes?
Mm-hmm.
And their plan is really simple. It's we leave everything to our issue being the kids, and knock on wood, everyone's doing fine. Everyone's grown up. Everyone has, kids of their own. So their plan is to leave everything to their kids, and then their kids' kids, if something happens, their trust has rules for their grandkids, and a wonderful plan that Harry set up, the type of plan that we do all the time. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So what's there to talk about? Well, they had a lot of things not in the trust.
Mm.
And I was explaining to them, look, when you do a revocable trust, Jamie doesn't care if you put everything in the trust or not, because we're not trying to protect things. We just want to make sure that the rules that you put on your money governs all of your assets. And we had a little discussion about how things that are not in your trust may not be governed by the rules of your trust.
Mm-hmm.
So as an example, for me, since I have two little kids, or even for you, because you may not think your kids should get all the money immediately if something happened to you and Mike, you need to kind of link your, something like life insurance to your estate planning documents to make sure that your beneficiaries are still covered by the rules. Like, I can't have my two little kids be a beneficiary of my life insurance with just their names, because all the rules in my will and trust that talk about hold things until they're 30 won't apply. Because when you avoid probate, it gets a little complicated. So I'll shut up for a moment. What are your thoughts so far?
No, that's absolutely true. You have to look at everything. You have to look at beneficiary designations everywhere on life insurance, retirement plans. I mean, many times, I'm sure you get this, we ask about beneficiaries and they have each other, right? The couple has each other as a beneficiary, but they don't remember if they named the contingent beneficiary. Or many times we find out that they didn't. And that's where you sometimes find out their contingent beneficiaries don't match their plan anymore. So you have to update both the trust and the beneficiaries at the same time. I had a case like that go wrong once where the individual died and he had a great trust set up in his will for his two children, but he had never changed the life insurance beneficiary. Yeah. So even though there was great trust out there, his children were getting a lot of money at 18.
So money without any rules. Sorry, go ahead.
Yes, rules, right. And they were teenagers when he passed away, so they were getting a lot of money pretty soon. That's a lot for a child to go through. And we weren't sure if the kids were going to use the money for college or if they were going to, basically spend it on something else. So that you don't have any control in that situation.
Exactly right. So let me ask you a quick question. So what's the spread between your boys? What's the age difference?
They're 2 years and 4 months apart.
Okay. So a lot of people, when they have multiple kids, sometimes they won't link their backup beneficiaries to their documents. So they do have their little kids, their newborn, as a backup beneficiary on life insurance. And then sometimes not only do they forget to link it to their documents, a will or a trust, but they may just forget to update it to reflect they have two kids now.
Right.
And they still have their eldest child as the sole backup on stuff or the sole beneficiary on something. And then, you know, if God forbid something happened to them, there's, you know, legally it belongs to one child in that
right.
instance, which, you know, forget all the other things that you're talking about, but like just from the who gets what part, like that's the easiest part of estate planning for us because we don't make any decisions or suggestions really. We just listen to what the client says. And then our job is to say, all right, well, this document can accomplish this and this and this, but you also have that retirement account. You also have that life insurance account. And I hope the life insurance is worthless because you outlive your term or whatever, the, you know, kind of policy you have. But we fail if the wrong people get money at the wrong time. And you mentioned getting money at 18. If you are 18 and, let's say, inherit $100,000, that's a lot of money. That's a lot of money unless it makes you decide that you don't need to go to college or you don't need to do this or you don't need to do that because you're rich, because you're not rich. You have $100,000. And if you continue making money elsewhere and you're you know, mind your business, that may be a wonderful jump start to your life to get that kind of money. But it's not, hey, I'm not going to go to school anymore money. But at 18, you don't know. That's a lot of money at 18.
Right. Right. You can think you don't need to go to school then because you have enough money for a car and an apartment or whatever you need to do.
So the way, Jamie, people can link their money to their trust is obviously you could, like, retitle the asset to now be inside the trust. That's one option. You could also, for a lot of times, just name the trust as a beneficiary.
Yeah.
But then it gets a little confusing because your trust says who gets what. And sometimes that account, that thing you put in the trust, says who gets what. So I know you have people who, for example, will put life insurance. They'll put the ownership of the policy into the trust. They'll retitle the brokerage account to into the trust. But then they keep a beneficiary on the actual account by accident. And all of a sudden that beneficiary controls instead of the language of the trust.
That's right. And, I mean, that can mess up your whole plan, right? You thought you had it going a certain way in the trust, but you forgot to change who the beneficiary was.
Or remove the beneficiary in this instance, I guess.
Well, I was thinking making the trust the beneficiary, right? Or just removing them. Right. It all has to go point to the same place eventually, so it goes to the same beneficiaries.
Exactly right. And I don't know if you remember, a couple of weeks ago we had a caller who had talked about a bank account, and the question was, is this bank account accessible after a death, and who has this money? And, you know, there's this world of who gets what, but then there's also the world of we don't want to overcomplicate things, we do want to avoid probate. So a lot of times you have clients who will, as they're getting older, maybe put one of their three kids, the one who's most local, let's say, they'll put them on the bank account, right, to help pay bills, and they don't need to carry on the power of attorney everywhere they go, so they add the son to the bank account. Now, that means that upon the death of the other owners of the account, mom and dad, that money goes where? It goes to that one child.
Right.
And the understanding is that child's going to play nice and share with the siblings because in reality, he was only on there for convenience purposes. But we don't want to say that out loud because we don't want to probate that money. We want to say, no, they did want him to have it as long as he plays ball and gives it to his siblings. So that adds this other layer because sometimes people leave assets entirely out of the trust, like bank accounts, personal bank accounts, checking savings. And they will put one of their kids on, and, you know, as when it works, it's fine. When everyone's playing nice, it's fine. But technically, that child doesn't have to share the money.
Yeah, they don't. I mean, I'm in a case where we're litigating a convenience account, so I'm pretty hesitant of putting your child on all of your accounts, you know. Certainly your checking account or maybe a small savings account to help pay bills, but when you put your child on a lot of accounts or that whole large amount of money, that can get confusing. Did you really want them to get that money instead of the other children? Or was it still a convenience account for you? So that gets really tricky to prove that.
I think you said a large amount of money. Where we see probably the most is it's a relatively small amount of money, under 10 grand. And the idea is this account will be used to pay final expenses and carrying costs of the property until it's sold and you know, stuff like that. So it's not like there's a big amount to give out. This particular client from yesterday had several hundred thousand dollars in the bank. So there, you know, you got to have a lot of trust in that child who's on that account. I don't want to put, you know, five names on a bank account. That's a little silly as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then people came and say, well, okay, makes sense. Dave, makes sense, J. Marie. I'm just going to leave my son on as power of attorney. I'll add him to the account, but it'll be as power of attorney. And there we run into another problem because if you die, well, then that power of attorney died with you. And now we have to go through probate for that bank account. So you got to really be careful as to how you put these things. And most of it, J. Marie, isn't like, you know, you're not doing legal work on this. I wasn't doing legal work. I was giving advice and just explaining.
Right.
So much of estate planning ends up not being legal, I guess, or not legal work.
Yeah, it's not necessarily the legal document. It's telling you to figure out from all your assets how you want things to go, what's practical, right, for paying bills. I still think, yeah, come back to if you're going to put someone on the account, it should be for the smaller accounts just to help pay bills so you don't run into that problem later on. Because you never know, like that child could say, of course, I'm going to share it with my siblings to the parents. And then they may change their mind afterwards. You know, they may say, well, I was the only one who helped take care of mom. No one else came around. So I'm entitled to more money, right? And that's usually where we run into problems.
I'm in the camp of if you're going to use an attorney, and you're going to spend money, good money on a will, good money on a trust. And, you know, in case of trust, it might be, you know, several thousand dollars. If you're going to invest in that estate plan for yourself, then I want to use the heck out of it. Like, I want to take most advantage of it. I'm sitting in a car that's got 240,000 miles on it. I don't want to get rid of this car ever. I want to get every ounce of mileage from this automobile. You know what I'm saying? And because I spent good money on it. I want to get my money's worth and then some. And it seems like I am because we do a lot of driving. But with a trust, with a will, with your estate plan, I feel like the same way. And your will, your trust has all sorts of language. You know, what to other people would be boilerplate, to us is that those just-in-case provisions. What happens if your kid's predeceased you? What happens if, unbeknownst to you, one of your beneficiaries has a drug problem? Our default language in our documents talks about those things, gives some discretion to the executor or the trustee to hold money longer or give money earlier if it's a good kid, you know, adjust to whatever life is throwing at you. So in my mind, I'm like, you not only did you spend money on this thing, but it covers all these different circumstances. I want as much as possible to go through that trust. We don't get a dollar from that, Jamie. We just make sure that you're avoiding probate, so that saves you money. We make sure that your estate plan, your choices as to who gets what, we make sure that happens because that's why you called us to begin with, right?
So to
make sure it all lines up perfectly, I think using your documents as much as possible makes the most sense. And just as an example, I'm sorry I'm taking up all the air here, but they just had so many examples of this. So you have an account, and you put, what if we put all three kids' names as beneficiary, transfer on death on this bank account? I said, that's fine. It avoids probate. However, if one of your kids predeceased you, where does that money go? And if it's $400,000 in the bank, that's a lot of money. Where does that money go? It doesn't go to your grandkids under that one predeceased child. It's going to go based on whatever the bank says happens when a TOD beneficiary dies. There's no rules on that money. So while you can say, well, our kids are doing great, and if we die tomorrow, we just want them to get it. We don't want to overcomplicate things and use the trust. Mm-hmm. If you can guarantee me that, and we're only talking about tomorrow, I guess that works. But if we're talking about leaving it like that for years, bad things happen, and your trust takes that into account.
Right. You can't put all these contingencies on your beneficiaries, on your TODs, but the trust, you could build in different contingencies. And getting back to where, if, you know, let's say the parent wants to give one child more money because they were the caregiver, it's cleaner if you do that in your trust document or your will document, and you could state that they're to get a certain percentage. You know, when they're joint on the bank account, you have that question, was it really intended to go to them or was it a convenience account? So you can state certain things in your, you know, will and trust that would clear that up.
Absolutely. You know, Jamie, I think we do a lot of estate administration. That's like the back end. We, you know, what to do when a loved one dies, quote unquote. Are we terminating a trust? Are we going through a probate or an administration because there was no will or there was only a will? I feel like we have an unacceptable percentage of our probates where they're existing clients with trusts with us. And it's like an unacceptable amount of probate because there was some account somewhere that they didn't include in the plan post-trust signing. Do you see a lot of that?
I do, yeah, I do. They put most things in the trust, and then they do forget about one account where they could have either, you know, put a beneficiary on it or made a joint or something to avoid probate. So we do, sometimes we catch that where we tell you to come in, review your plan every couple of years, right? And that's the time where that would come up if we go through all their assets. But a lot of times it doesn't, and then we have to go through a probate just for that one asset, which really slows the whole process. Because the whole idea of having a trust was to make things quicker and easier.
I was literally going to say that exact thing, Jamie. You're so right. It defeats the purpose. And if we're doing a probate, you know, over $90,000 of assets or $490,000 of assets, other than the filing fee change, it's all the same work. So we literally, by going through a probate, defeated the whole purpose of that revocable trust. And I get a lot of times we meet with someone and we're done and they say, well, what do I do with all these things you told me to bring? You know, they have their tax returns. They have probate statements. Like, well, I didn't know what we were going to talk about. And those all may have been really important to go through. But at the very least, it's important for you to realize what you own, how you own it, who your beneficiaries are, make sure that everything links up, because it's not like we put a blindfold on and we say avoid probate. And so, there's a plan, there's rules, there's a certain distribution that you want to have happen. If you have, you know, a certain beneficiary getting 20% from your trust and that person isn't listed on one of your accounts, well, then big picture, when we look at who gets what as a result of your death, they're not getting 20%. They're getting less than 20% because they're not 20% on everything.
Right.
If you have a trust and you put everything in that trust, when you change your mind, you say, well, I want that person to get 25% now. You'll amend one document one time. You don't have to go through, you know, 8 different beneficiary designation forms to make sure that every form says every asset goes 25% to that person. So, you know, if you do a trust, use it. Absolutely. And then if you don't have a trust, doesn't mean, you know, this discussion doesn't mean you need to have a trust, but you might, and you probably should talk to us about it.
Yeah, that's right. I'm sure you've done this exercise I have of going through, you know, all the accounts and showing, like, financially how much each person would get, because it's complicated if you have different percentages on your, you know, life insurance than you do in your will. I mean, it's easier if it's all the same. I know this is kind of changing topics a little bit, but one time where you might want different beneficiaries is if you have charitable beneficiaries, because I had that with a client this week, who they're definitely leaving some money to charity. So instead of putting that in the will, we decided to put the charities on the IRA account.
Oh, I like that.
And that's to, I mean, it's all going to come out the same percentages, but the charity is going to not pay any taxes. So actually, it's not the same percentages, right? You're increasing the amount that's going to your children a little bit by doing that. So that's one time maybe where you wouldn't have your beneficiaries match your will, but it makes sense to save taxes.
Jerry, we have like 3 minutes before the break here. Do you mind just peeling that one more layer? So you're leaving money to charity, you're leaving money to people, and I think incredibly brilliant on your part to differentiate and say, well, look, we leave the IRA to people, they're going to take money out over a certain period of time because that's what the government says you got to do. They pay taxes on that. So what are you suggesting the client do?
Well, so if you have $100,000 in your IRA that you're leaving to someone, they're not really getting $100,000, right? Because they have to pay taxes on it. So maybe they're getting like $70,000 instead. Instead, if you make a charity the beneficiary, the charity doesn't have to pay taxes. So they're going to get all that money. And then, you know, you leave your kids on another account where they're going to get the money without having to pay taxes. So you're trying to pick the account that would give them the most money.
And one more layer, they're not the money that goes to the kids, is not going to be subject to tax. Why?
Oh, because inheritance is not taxed. And that's the misconception we get all the time, that someone comes in, you know, how much money do I have to pay on my inheritance? Or I got gifted money, don't I have to pay taxes on that? And usually, I'm sure you do this too, I say, all right, let's take a deep breath. Do you have $12 million? No,
right? I say to the nearest $10 million, how much do we have?
Right. So you don't have to worry about that because you only pay estate tax if you have more than $12 million. So for 99% of the people, any money you inherit or any money that you receive as a gift, you're not paying any taxes on, unless it's an IRA account. And that's income taxes you're paying on the IRA, not estate taxes. So that's a different calculation. That's a different story. You can't change the income taxes on the IRA.
Sounds good. I think we're probably at the break. Ben, are we there?
Boy, are you sure are clairvoyant there, Dave. We are. It's coming up to the bottom of the hour. We'll take our break right here. We'll be right back with the second half of the Herzog Law Firm's Estate Medicaid Planning Hour coming up right after this.
You've been listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. Join us every week to learn more about protecting the assets you've worked hard for, options available for Medicaid planning, and more. With offices located in Corporate Woods in Albany, West Harrison Street in Saratoga Springs, Executive Woods in Clifton Park, and 130 North Front Street in Kingston, our attorneys are here to help you. If you'd like to schedule an appointment to speak with David, Jane Marie, or Harry, please call us during normal business hours, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. To contact us at our Albany office, call 518-465-7581. Our Saratoga Springs office, 518-581-8131. Our Clifton Park office at 518-952-4010. And our Kingston office at 845-338-6405. Let the Herzog Law Firm help navigate a plan that works for you and your family. Now back to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Hi, welcome back to the Herzog Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour. I'm Jay Marie Schaefer.
Morning, everyone. I'm Dave Kubikin.
And this is a call-in show. We would love to have you call in. We can answer your questions. Our number is 518-476-5900 if you want to give us a call. Ben would be happy to take your call, or if you don't want to talk on the radio, he sometimes has passed on the question to us himself. That's an option. So we spent the first half hour, it was a really good conversation, talking about trust and beneficiaries and making sure your beneficiary designations match your whole estate plan. It's really important because you have to coordinate all that. We've seen cases where you have a beautiful will or a trust that says everything you want, but one wrong beneficiary designation can mess that all up. It could go to someone you didn't want to. Go ahead, Dave. It's hard when I can't see you. Sorry.
I know. Well said, Jamrie. I'd like to change gears for a moment, and callers, please call, because you could, get your questions answered. I want to bring up a topic that also came up this week, and it's so this is not about trust. This is about what to do when you did nothing. If you never did a lick of planning, mm-hmm. and let's say all you did was a good power of attorney, what happens if we do have long-term care needs? What happens if we don't have a trust and nothing's protected? Is all lost? The answer is no, all is not lost. It might be half is lost, though, depending on how the numbers shake out, or up to half is lost. And what mm-hmm. I'm talking about is something called a gift and loan plan that we do sometimes, where we have mm-hmm. someone come in, their loved one maybe went to the hospital, then went to a rehab facility, and they're being told by everyone who has an opinion on the matter, dad can't go home anymore. He needs to stay in skilled nursing. And we say, well, okay, that's not good. What makes it worse is that dad had about $850,000 in things that Medicaid would consider to be an asset and or resource. And so Medicaid is not going to, the facility says, well, we'll do the Medicaid app. Well, it doesn't matter who does the app because he's not going to get in. He's not going to get approved because he's got way too much, right? The threshold that you mentioned all the time, Jamrie, is $16,800. That's, $850,000 is a lot more than that. So when people come in like that, we say, well, we now we're doing some, we're at advanced level estate planning and we're, school's in session in the office. Mm-hmm. We're using the whiteboard. We're doing, drawing this, drawing that. And the idea is that we can save about half your money by gifting half of it today. And you say, wait a minute, there's a five-year look-back period. That's silly. Well, we gift half of it, and then we loan the other half of it to the same person, usually. And the loan is not just some random promissory note we put together. Everything's on the up and up, but it's calculated almost to the penny to take into account the length of the penalty associated with giving away half your money. You can't just give away half your money. Good time to let everyone, remind everyone, Medicaid does not take your money. They say you do not qualify. That's it. And then you take your own money and you private pay a facility. So when we gift half your money, it's going to result in a penalty, and there's a whole formula for it. And in this case, the penalty is going to be about 32 months. Jamrie. So okay. A little, almost, two and a half years, So that's a long period of time. And we have no idea what, in this case, it's mom, by the way, we have no idea what her longevity is going to be, especially in skilled nursing. Could be a couple years, could be a couple days, could be, 10 years. So there's still something for the family to do. Although with that kind of money, for the next 32 months at least, we are going to essentially be private paying for the care. And people are going to say, well, you keep saying a nursing home is $15,000 a month. This particular one is $500 a day. So it amounts to being about $15,000 a month. So that's a lot of money. We don't have that money. How are we going to possibly private pay? And the answer is we take mom's income and we take all of those loan dollars that you're repaying to mom, because that was a loan, it was a real loan, and we make the length of the loan, again, the length of the penalty. So every month, you're going to give back mom, $11,000, $12,000 from the money you borrowed from her, quote-unquote borrowed from her. And we use that in mom's Social Security or her pension or her IRA distribution or whatever to cobble up the $15,000 every month. And we do that each and every month until the penalty is over. And then some, magical time between month 32 and month 33 in this fact pattern, Medicaid will start paying, and they'll pay every month thereafter. And it's not cheap to do this kind of plan, but that first month, if we get to month 33, Jamie. That's when all of a sudden the client will have saved probably more than what our fee was just in that month alone. You kind of have no choice but to do it unless there's really good certainty that mom's just not going to make it that long. Because if they do, well, you could save money earlier. You don't have to private pay 33 months. If you did nothing, Jamie, you're private paying for the rest of that person's life.
Yeah, right? Or until you run out.
Or you run out of money.
All right.
So everyone out there, if you don't have a trust that's been in existence for 5 years, has this point in time, in this case it's 32.7 months down the road. Other people, it might be 3 months. Other people, because they have so much, they have millions of dollars, it's 60 months. It's a full 5 years to get through. But for most people, it might be a year, it might be 8 months. And after that point, Medicaid will take over payment. And it's really important for people to understand that this is an option. There's always something we could do. We say, 5 years before or 5 days before, there's always something we can do with a good power of attorney, at least. And so the family now is there, listeners, their brains might be scrambled after hearing all this on the radio. The client's kids are kind of all over the place because it's a lot to take in. And, what do you mean? We're loaning money. We're gifting money. This is all very confusing, but it's all for the greater good. This possible date down the road, 32 months down the road, where the worst case would be private paying $800,000 worth of things, and we're kind of going to make the worst case instead be private paying about $400,000 and saving $400,000. I like the savings part. I don't like the paying part, though. And that's why, we come back to trust on it. But you've done a number of these loan and gift plans. What are your thoughts on them?
There's almost no reason not to do it because you're not going to lose out, right? You were paying privately anyway, so you might as well do the plan. It certainly makes sense when it's a short period of time. That's an easy one to think about. But even when it's a 2.5 year, it makes sense, right? Again, it depends on the health of the person, but you never know. We've seen so many clients, who were, we thought they weren't going to make it, and they pull through, and they make it, and they're, so you can't really determine that. I think it's better to try and do the plan. At the end, you could save a lot of money. If they don't make it through, you didn't lose anything because you were paying privately anyway. So I almost can't think of a case where it wouldn't make sense to do the plan.
Well, I actually have one for you, and it's not the way that you would think, because I know what you're saying. You're saying on day one, why not do this? Because you didn't have any other plan. You're going to private pay the whole time. The next layer of it, though, is sometimes you have a client who is 3 years into their trust, or they're 3.5 years into their trust. I have a family member who's 3.5 years into their trust. And if they were 4.5 years into their trust, we would be, 6 months away from the 5 years. So the things we would do for those 6 months would be just to get us to the 5 years. So there's that break-even point. And when people come in, and the question always when they do a trust, almost every time there's a trust signing for a Medicaid trust, they ask you, Jamie, well, okay, so now what happens if I don't make it 5 years?
Almost every
time. The
answer
always is, the answer is it depends. Did it happen 3 months from now? Well, we're blowing up the trust. We're doing the loan and gift plan, or we're relying on a child caretaker exemption. We're relying on your spouse or a disabled child exemption. If it's 4 years from now, well, even though it's not appetizing, I may say I think you just need to private pay a year. Because it's better than the result of the loan and gift that Jamie was just talking about. And it actually ends up being pretty interesting. And in some fact patterns, particularly when people do have $850,000 that they throw in a trust, the earlier you do the trust, you got to get through 5 years, right? It's an all or nothing proposition on protecting. But the closer you get to the 5 years, even though your assets aren't, 60% protected, if you get 60% of the way to the 5 years, it's important to know that your break-even point, the math has shifted because you only have 2 more years to worry about. Maybe we can make home care work out for you for 2 years. It's possible, because we just need to get to the five-year mark. And that interplay between what do you already have, what are the assets Medicaid cares about, what's the family tree, is there some exemption we can use, and then worst case, what's the math on this 50-50 plan, roughly speaking? It's at least for me, it's the part of my job that I love the most. Not that the clients are going through this, but that I think there's a way to help them, and we can maximize the benefit to them because of everything we know. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, it makes you think outside the box. You know, each case is different. And to go back kind of to what I was talking about in the first half hour, IRAs come back into play again. So if you had a trust and you had IRAs outside the trust, and then at some point you needed to pay for care, you could use the IRA money because even though that would be taxable, you get a deduction for the money you're paying to the nursing home. So, so that's another thing I've looked at sometimes to see if that works out, where you don't even have to touch the money that's in the trust. And, you know, a couple of years ago, that may not have made sense because when you inherit an IRA, you can defer it over your lifetime, so there's some tax savings there. But now when your beneficiary inherits the IRA, they have to take all that money out within 10 years. So you're not able to defer that as long as you could. So it may be a better choice to use that money to pay the nursing home bill because you're never going to have as big a medical bill as you would when you're paying a nursing home, and use that as your medical deduction.
See, guys, this is why J. Marie is so smart. People don't think this way. It's very, I like it, J. Marie. Very nice.
I know. I say that I like taxes. I'm kind of weird. So.
You're the life of the party. That's all.
Yeah, that's the party.
Everyone gravitates towards you. Let's hear some taxes.
That's right. Hey, if you want to give us a call, if you have questions about this, it's 518-476-5900. Please give us a call. Or if you want to have an individual consultation, you can call our office,
I gave the wrong number last weekend. I realized it's 465-7581. I had to write it down. Ben, you'll appreciate this. I write down the numbers every time now.
I absolutely appreciate it.
There's no shame in admitting you're getting old, you know?
That's right.
Write it down.
No problem.
Plus, all the numbers are kind of similar, you know? They both
Are.
Medicare, Medicaid. I can understand how people confuse the two. They look alike. Mm-hmm. They sound alike.
That's right. At least I still remember your name. So.
Right. So there's one more piece to this whole Medicaid discussion. And I've not talked to you about it, Jamie. I'd love to know your philosophy on it. So if you own a home and it's a primary residence and you need a nursing home, that means you're not going to live in that home anymore.
Right.
But because it was your primary residence, if you intend to return home, when we do a Medicaid application for you, Medicaid will approve you even though you have that $400,000 home paid for.
Right.
And what they'll proceed to do normally is they will keep track of how much money they're spending on your care while you're qualified, and they will put a lien on your residence in that amount. So that amount essentially goes up on a monthly basis as they're paying more money for your needs. But the amount of the lien that Medicaid pays isn't just some random number, and it's actually not as high as you might think it is. So whereas Jay Marie would pay 15 grand for her nursing home a couple decades from now, if she needs one, so that's $15,000. Well, Medicaid doesn't pay $15,000, do they, Jay Marie?
No, they're probably paying half of that. So what you're saying is you're really paying back Medicaid at the lower rate that they're paying than what you would pay at the $15,000 rate. So sometimes that's a little hard to wrap your head around, but you may want to incur that
Yep. Well, so there's a couple moving parts to it, but you're absolutely right. So if Medicaid pays $7,500, well, the lien would be no more than $7,500 per month. That's a lot of money. However, that's not what the lien is going to be, because Medicaid will say, well, you do have that Social Security, don't you? You do have that IRA distribution. You do have that pension. So if you have, say, $3,000, $4,000 of income, and that's what Dad has, well, the lien may only be $3,500 a month. And when we're talking about how long is Dad in a nursing home, and we're talking about these unfortunate parts of life, if there's no difference to the care, we turn our attention to how can we preserve money. And if we look at our crystal ball and we say, well, you know what, Dad may not be here next Christmas, unfortunately, the way things are going. This is what the doctors are saying. But for now, he needs skilled nursing. I may say, well, guys, you may want to say instead, let's intend to return home. First of all, if he goes home, by the way, Jamie, the lien vanishes if he ends up going home ever. But if he doesn't go home, that amount you essentially private paid was his income plus the amount of that lien. And it may be, at least, I call it the friends and family rate. I'd rather have the friends and family rate at the nursing home than what Medicaid, than what the private pay rate is. Now, it's not as simple as that, because the house still has expenses. You got to come up with that. You don't have the income. Dad's income's already being taken by Medicaid. So, you know, there's some other considerations to it, some math to it. And down the road, a couple of months later, maybe you do decide to sell the house. Maybe that was the plan all along. But we just want to get Medicaid qualified as soon as possible. So if you sell the property 3 months in, 8 months in, Jay Marie, and all of a sudden at the closing, there's, you know, $400,000 that goes back to Dad. Well, what do we do then? We do that whole 50-50 plan, the loan and gift plan, to save half of that money, at least.
David, Jay Marie, we do have a caller on the line. We have John in Burnt Hills.
Hey, John.
Good morning.
Good morning. My question is, I have an IRA account, and I also have a trust. I have a non-IRA account in that trust. Now, when the time comes, I have to take the RMD out every year. Should I roll that into that trust account, or I know that starts a look-back period for that amount I roll in, or should I move it someplace else?
Well, that's a good question, John. So what you're talking about is, what do you do with all that? You're saying you don't need that IRA distribution, and you're saying, what do I do with it? I don't need it. And so if you're not going to go out on the town or go on vacation or, you know, donate it or give it or spend it or whatever, I'd say if you already have a trust and you don't need that money, throw it in the trust. And while it starts a five-year look-back period, it only starts it for that money.
That's
and
correct.
If you put it anywhere else, it's not getting protected anywhere else. So my 2 cents would be, I would throw it in the trust, but to be honest, I would make sure I'm not going to be spending it, and make sure there's not something I want to do, because, you know, it's your money, enjoy it, but I would put it in the trust if you're not going to enjoy it.
Because I take the income from it. I take the income that comes off that trust and off the IRA account. And the principal, gotcha. I roll that into the IRA. I roll that into the trust.
When you say principal, do you mean the distribution from the IRA, or what do you mean by principal?
Yes, the dividends that come off the IRA every year.
I see. They
pay a dividend, so I take the dividends, but I roll the principal in there. I roll the RMD that I'm required to take into the trust.
Gotcha. Perfect. So you still will pay taxes on that RMD in the year that you take it, but then you would throw it into the trust. And thanks so much for the call, John. I had a client, Jamery, that he's a doctor who was still practicing, and he was already getting his RMD, but he didn't want to stop working. So we did a trust for him where we threw the house in the trust. And, you know, I said, well, I wish there was more we could put in the trust. And he said, well, you know, I'm about to take this distribution. This is back when it was 70 and a half to take your distribution. I said, I don't know what to do with it. I said, well, why don't you throw it in the trust every year for each year you're working here going forward? When you feel like you're not working anymore, you use the income and enjoy it. But every year he would throw his RMD after taxes into the trust. And I said, look, 15 years from now, if you need a nursing home, those first 10 years of contribution and whatever they grew to would be outside the 5 years. And there you go.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. A lot of people do put IRA distributions in. Some people have just gotten used to living on their Social Security or their pension, because you don't even have to take your IRAs until you're 72. So by the time you get taking it out, you realize, I may not need this. Certainly a good idea to put it in the trust and protect it.
Or try to, because, you could always remove it. You know, like the quote unquote irrevocable trusts aren't as inaccessible as people think. They hear irrevocable and they freak out. And we certainly don't have enough time to explain irrevocable, revocable. But we do have enough time to remind people that they could go to our website, herzoglaw.com, www.herzoglaw.com, and you can click on the seminar page. And there's a whole slew of webinars we've done, or a schedule for the upcoming ones in April, where you could just find out more about this stuff. You know, I think listening on the radio is certainly a good option, but it's kind of random, right? Does it happen to be that Jamie Ray and Dave are going to talk about the topic you care about this week? Or do you just go to the website and listen to the topic you want to hear about for an hour?
That's right. Yeah, I'm just looking on there. Your recent aging in place one is on there. My recent Medicaid planning myths is on there. So there's a lot of good webinars on there that you can check out and watch, you know, at your convenience. Yeah.
You know, Jamie, a lot of we're in like tax season, heavy into tax season. We're getting a lot of those now. How do I do my taxes with this trust that I have? Do you mind spending a couple minutes just talking about specifically the Medicaid trust and how income works when the trust is generating income?
Sure. We do get a lot of calls, and undoubtedly I've seen a lot of people do it wrong despite us giving instructions. It's actually kind of simple. The Medicaid trust, for tax purposes, is called a grantor trust. So that means that And you're the grantor, the person who set up the trust is the grantor. That means you report everything on your own income tax return. The trust doesn't have to pay any taxes. Now, that being said, you have to file a trust tax return. It's more like an information return is what they call returns, where you're not paying any taxes. So you're just reporting the income that the trust made, and then you have a statement that you attach saying, all of this income is being reported on the grantor's income tax return. So the IRS sees a trust tax return was filed, and then they can trace the income back to you, and then you report it. Some people choose to do it themselves. It's not that hard. Or if you have someone preparing it for you, you need to tell them it's a grantor trust tax return, because if you don't tell your tax preparer that, they may assume it's a type of trust where the trust pays its own taxes. And if you do it that way, the trust is you're going to pay more income taxes than you would if you put it on your own. Because generally, trusts pay income taxes at higher rates on lower amounts of income.
That was perfect, Jamie. Gosh, you're very succinct, and you've been practicing this whole income tax thing, I guess. Wow. I would have butchered it. I would have been all over the place. So to be clear, though, the client pays the taxes. And the question I get all the time is, well, what happens if I don't file that information return you're talking about? And that's where it gets icky, because technically you got to do it. But also, I don't know what happens if you don't do something that doesn't require a payment. There's no interest and penalty on, you know.
Right. There's probably
Yeah, I was going to say, technically, there's, you know, an argument to be said that maybe if you're not filing the required tax returns for the trust, your trust shouldn't be recognized as a Medicaid trust, because you're not doing the taxes the right way, I suppose. So, you know, you should do it. It's required when there's, what, $600 of income or more, something like that?
Yep, $600 is the cutoff.
But you know, we say all the time, your trust is a tax neutral thing, specifically the Medicaid trust or the revocable. There are other kinds of irrevocable trusts out there with different tax consequences. There are non-grantor trusts that, you know, don't allow someone to get what we call a step up in the tax basis. It's just a completely different vehicle for completely different reasons. That Medicaid trust, it's really a trust for you during your life, with the added benefit that it does happen to protect assets for the specific reason of long-term care and Medicaid. It's not like others. So be careful with your Googling when you talk to your accountant and you say, yeah, I just did an irrevocable trust this year. And he says, oh, my God, I can't believe you did that.
Right.
You lost, you know, he may not realize it's not a generic irrevocable trust. It's a Medicaid Asset Protection Trust, which is a, was that a grantor trust, right, Jamie?
Yes. And just for any of our clients who've done our trust, call our office. We have instructions on how to do the tax returns. Stacy has those. We give them out to clients every year. It's really helpful, and it goes through in detail how to do the tax return.
Right. It's that time of year, tax time. For me, it's time to watch commercials for the Masters because it's the greatest golf tournament in the world. Ben, you're a big Masters guy?
It is the best weekend of the entire year. Yeah, I hear that music and I just get weepy. That's how good it is.
Yeah. You hear the birds chirping.
Oh, yeah, the fake birds that they used to funnel in to make it sound like they actually had them. Yes, it was awesome. Yep.
I am bored to death on TV, so I'll leave that to you guys.
it's like, Jamer, it's like HD TVs were meant for the Masters tournament because that course is so pristine and how they have, you know, the flowers everywhere, the birds, oh man. I can't wait.
Enjoy it.
Have a good weekend, guys.
Have a good weekend.
Thank you for listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. For more information on their services, please visit herzoglaw.com. If you'd like to speak with one of their attorneys, please contact the Albany office at 518-465-7581, the Saratoga office at 518-581-8131, or their Kingston office at 845-338-6405.